From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What you don't know can hurt you, so you might as well find out about the invisible poisons in your food, the pesticides, chemicals, bacteria, and who knows what else. Michael Jacobson is the co-author of the new book, Safe Food. He gives us some advice on today's Fresh Air. Also today, Blanche Boyd discusses womanhood and the American South. She's the author of many essays on the subject and of a new novel called The Revolution of Little Girls. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles one of the early greats of gospel music, Blind Willie Johnson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In New York City, the United Nations Security Council is to meet this evening to consider what action, if any, to take against Iraq because of possible violations in reporting all of its nuclear facilities. Linda Fasulo has more.
Earlier this week, Iraq twice refused to allow a UN team of experts entry to a suspected nuclear installation. After access was given earlier today, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency reported back to the UN that materials had been removed and activities which had been observed earlier had stopped. This afternoon, a U.S. team of experts presented details of the Iraqi operation to Security Council members in a closed session. After the meeting, U.S. Envoy Alexander Watson described the missing equipment as components designed to enrich uranium by electromagnetic separation, a process he said that had been used by the U.S. during World War II. And the American diplomat then accused Iraq of deliberately trying to deceive the world body. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Iraqi President Saddam Hussein today blamed the United States and its allies for the Shiite and Kurdish uprisings after the Persian Gulf War. In a televised speech, Saddam said his Gulf War enemies had tried to divide him from the people, and he indirectly urged Iraqis to rally around his leadership. Saddam appeared to acknowledge that the government had made mistakes, and he said that certain officials had failed in their duty toward the Iraqi people. The speech was given before a group of religious and tribal leaders from the Shiite holy city of Najaf. Soviet troops today seized the central telephone exchange in Lithuania, temporarily cutting the republic's communications with the outside world. The troops left after a two-hour occupation. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Today's action is the latest in a long-running intimidation campaign against the rebellious Lithuanians who want to secede from the Soviet Union. Interior Ministry troops said they took over the telephone exchange in the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius in order to search for weapons there. A Lithuanian journalist denounced the action as a military provocation. He charged that a container of weapons seized by the troops had been specially planted for today's raid. Lithuanian residents said all long-distance telephone service was cut during the raid, but service resumed when the troops left. Soviet troops have occupied several key buildings in Vilnius, including the city's broadcast tower, which was seized in a bloody attack last January that left 14 people dead. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 2,913. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of 187 million shares. This is NPR News. Two Catholic priests were arrested today for trespassing as they protested a brewery's plan to market a high-alcohol drink they claim is aimed at young black men. The priests, George Clements and Mike Flager, were arrested in the lobby of the G. Heilemann Brewing Company in La Crosse, Wisconsin. They claim that Heilemann's Power Master malt liquor, which has an alcohol content almost twice that of beer, is named and advertised in such a way as to attract young black men. Yesterday, 21 advocacy groups said they'd ask federal regulators to define malt liquor as containing no more alcohol than beer. The Senate has moved to expand the death penalty to apply to 49 more crimes and to allow executions to be carried out more quickly. Today, Republicans prevailed on an administration-backed measure that would limit the appeals filed by death row inmates. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Senate approved President Bush's proposal today to block what's known as habeas corpus petitions in federal court. Under the proposal, death row inmates couldn't file such an appeal unless a judge found that state courts treated the defendant unfairly and the defendant filed the appeal within 6 months. Democrats had supported a less restrictive version, arguing that the Republican proposal sacrificed justice in the interest of speedy executions. Minority Leader Bob Dole said the appeals are clogging the system.
How much longer should the victim's family have to tolerate the thought that the defendant escapes his punishment by filing repetitive appeals? 10 more years? 20 more years?
The Senate hopes to finish work by the end of this week, but Senator Jesse Helms may block debate on gun control with an amendment to ban job preference based on race, a measure that's totally unrelated to the crime bill. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Telephone company officials in Washington, D.C. say that a computer malfunction is to blame for phone service disruptions in the nation's capital and parts of 3 neighboring states. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know, eating isn't what it used to be. You want to be healthy, so maybe you cut down on red meat and eat more fish. Well, then you find out about the toxins the fish have absorbed from polluted waters. You eat more fruits and vegetables. But what about the pesticides? Well, what is safe to eat? My guest Michael Jacobson is the author of a new book called Safe Food. Jacobson is the executive director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. One of his previous books was a guide to the fat content, calories, and nutritional value in the burgers, fries, and shakes of competing fast food chains. Well, he has some advice for us. The newest appliance in a lot of kitchens is the microwave oven. Are microwaves safe? Jacobson says we don't have to worry about radiation.
The radiation problem has been taken care of by the manufacturers, but there is a problem with microwave ovens, and that is that people become accustomed to thinking that they can have any food cooked or reheated in 5 seconds or 10 seconds. And if you don't cook foods thoroughly, bacteria can survive and thrive even in the center, the cold spots in the food.
No. What about the packaging that microwave foods come in the grocery? Are there any hazards with the packaging?
Some of the packaging is safe. Some of the packaging is untested. There is some packaging used for French fries and pizzas that has heat susceptors in it that get very, very hot. And chemicals from the packaging material have been approved for use at low temperatures, never at these high temperatures, and they could get into the food. Whether they're dangerous or not, nobody knows. So we advise people to play it safe, either not use heat susceptor packaging or foods packaged in those products, or remove the foods from the packaging and put them in glass bowls. And in general, glass is the best thing to use in a microwave oven. There are no government standards for microwave safe, even though packaging oftentimes says microwave safe. The manufacturer puts that on whenever they want.
One of the really popular uses of microwaves at work as well as at home is making popcorn. Do you have anything to tell us about the packaging that the microwave popcorn comes in, or the butter or fake butter or whatever, the oil that's used on it? Any advice on microwave popcorn?
Well, there are really two issues there. One is that popcorn comes in the heat susceptor packaging from which chemicals can leach into the popcorn. And the second thing, and really a bigger problem, is that the popcorn often comes packed in a lot of oil. Sometimes it's coconut oil, the single worst kind of fat that we can be eating. It's a saturated fat that promotes heart disease. So we recommend air-popped popcorn. Whether you do it in a microwave, and you could do it in glass bowls. Some people use paper bags, though there may be a problem with that because a paper bag can burn if it gets too hot, or make it on top of a stove. But I think as far as popcorn is a wonderful food, it's basically a non-fat food naturally and tastes delicious. Air pop it.
And the only problem is if you really like popcorn, the air popped is pretty tasteless.
Well, people add spices. Sometimes I put curry powder on top of it, and you can use a little bit of margarine. That won't kill you.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Jacobson, and he's the head of the Center for Science and the Public Interest and co-author of the new book, Safe Food. Do you drink tap water or bottled water at home?
I drink tap water. I use regular Washington water, although sometimes we buy seltzer water or some bottled water. You know, it's hard to know about the safety of these bottled waters. They may be safer than tap water, or they may not be. There are almost no standards. Most bottled waters don't list chemicals on the side, so you have no idea how much sodium there is or how much fluoride. We need stronger government standards in that area.
If you want to know what's in the bottled water you're drinking, is there any way to find out?
The only way you could find out what's in bottled water is by writing the manufacturer and asking for the levels of different chemicals. And then you can compare those levels with the levels that are permitted in tap water. And you could find those out either from your local water supplier or the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA's Safe Drinking Water Hotline is 1-800-426-4791. That's 1-800-426-4791. And they can provide you with the different levels of various chemicals that are acceptable. And then you could compare those levels to the levels that are in your local water supply or in a bottled water.
What about filters for your tap? If you're going with tap water, are the filters effective?
Well, filters may be effective or they may not be effective, depending upon what kind of contaminants you have in your water. For instance, if you have bacterial contamination, some kinds of treatment techniques, like a water softener, is totally useless. Carbon is wonderful if you have organic chemicals, but useless for bacteria. So that's something you need to look into, and the Environmental Protection Agency's Safe Water Hotline can give you some help. And in our Safe Food Book, we have a handy chart that describes which treatment technique is appropriate for which particular kind of contaminant. And I should say that most big city water supplies have excellent water.
I have to say, though, I think where I live, the water tastes terrible, even if in the long run it's healthier than the bottled water might be. It's really unpleasant to drink, and I find even if you brew coffee with it, the coffee doesn't mask the bad flavor of the water.
Yeah, that can certainly happen, and is a reason people are turning to bottled water and paying a huge amount more than they are for tap water. And the least they should expect is that the water be safe. And right now we can't have that assurance. So you really have to be your own little consumer advocate and check out different waters.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Jacobson, the head of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, co-author of the new book, Safe Food. You know, a lot of us have either given up meat or eat a lot less meat and have turned to fish as the healthy alternative. And now we're learning about all the pollutants that are probably in a lot of the fish that we eat. So I really want to hear what you have to say about fish. A lot of the fish are swimming around in polluted waters. How much of that pollution ends up on our plate?
It depends on the fish. Some fish are wonderfully healthy. And those are the fish generally from the deep blue sea. Cod, haddock, pollock are very low-fat fish and very rarely contaminated. And those would really be the ones that I'd recommend. On the other hand, if you have fish from the Great Lakes or the lower Hudson River or sometimes the Chesapeake Bay, waters that are extremely polluted with PCBs and other industrial chemicals, then you have a real problem. And you should not eat very much, if any, of those fish. Some fish have bacterial contamination from raw sewage. We need better protection with regard to seafood, and some we can do ourselves and some we can't. Raw shellfish is probably the biggest safety problem in our food supply. A high percentage of raw shellfish is contaminated with bacteria. And if you don't know where the shellfish is coming from, don't eat it. Don't eat shellfish sold from a truck on the side of the road. It may be old, it may be illegally harvested. And California actually has warning notices advising people not to eat raw shellfish that came from the Gulf of Mexico. And it's really a sad commentary on our food supply when government agencies are telling us not to eat traditional foods like raw shellfish, like Lake Michigan fish. And pregnant women ought to be particularly careful and not only avoiding the generally contaminated fish with PCBs, but also avoiding fish that may contain mercury. That would include shark, swordfish, marlin.
If you're eating cooked seafood, are you okay?
Well, if you cook the seafood thoroughly, you're certainly protecting yourself from bacteria, and that's one of the major problems. So raw shellfish can be a problem. cook shellfish are no problem at all with regard to bacteria. And we do need to cook fish thoroughly. Don't have raw fish. Don't cut it open at the thickest part to make sure it's thoroughly cooked. But cooking isn't going to do away with the chemicals, the cadmium or the lead that may get into certain fish, or the PCBs. Those are organic chemicals or inorganic chemicals that we will accumulate, and they could cause some toxicity in us. So there we have to have really government agencies ensuring that the fish that's sold are safe.
So you'd like to see government agencies inspecting fish for chemical levels?
Government agencies should inspect fish both for chemicals and for bacteria. Those are really the two problems.
And what are they doing now?
Now there's almost no inspection. There's voluntary inspection. Some state governments try to close waters to harvesting shellfish or other fish, but it's really done on a spotty basis. The federal government is really just getting into this issue in this coming year. The Food and Drug Administration is going to be surveying all fish processing plants to check them out for safety. And the FDA is looking for stronger legislation that will give it authority to close down waters and hopefully to work with states, also to set more standards for different chemicals. There are very few standards. And so if you don't have any standards, there's no way that these items can be regulated. And actually, if I can jump from fish to poultry, poultry too is something that's often contaminated. And we should really assume that every chicken or turkey we buy is contaminated with bacteria, salmonella or campylobacter. And government agencies, every poultry processing plant has federal inspectors. They look at a poultry carcass for 2 seconds. And there's very little you can tell in 2 seconds, especially with regard to bacterial contamination. There's no way to detect it. There are no standards for bacterial contamination. So when these birds end up in the supermarket, practically all of them are contaminated.
But you can cook that out, right, if you cook it properly?
That's right. You can kill all the bacteria. And so if your chicken is cooked thoroughly, and again, cut it open at the thickest part, make sure it's well done, use a thermometer and get an internal temperature of 170 degrees. You should also realize that as you handle the chicken, it's contaminated, and that everything that touches it, the cutting board, your hands, the knives and forks that you use to cut it up, will be contaminated. Treat them as contaminated and wash everything with soap and water before the cutting board touches anything else, like vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So we really have to protect ourselves, since chicken is so often contaminated. We've urged the Department of Agriculture to require handling notices, reminding people that when they touch poultry, that they may have bacteria on their hands and on anything that touches the poultry.
What kind of bacteria is this? And if you contaminated another food, what would that mean?
Well, it's generally salmonella or campylobacter that could cause intestinal illnesses, stomach infections. And sometimes it's serious and sometimes it's mild. It's likely that elderly people and very young children will be harmed first, whereas strong middle-aged people will survive best. But there are roughly 80 million foodborne illnesses a year, 9,000 deaths a year in the United States. This is something that needs to be cleaned up.
Let me get back to fish for a second. You've advised us to eat fish that comes from the deep blue sea. I'm not that well educated about fish, although I eat a lot of it, so I'm never quite sure where these fish live, what kind of waters they swim in. Well, what about salmon? It's a very popular fish.
Well, salmon is a fish that is both from the deep blue sea, where it spends most of its life, but then it's often harvested near shore. And salmon is one of the better fish. So enjoy your salmon. And actually, you know, one thing we try to do in Safe Food is not to scare people to death. We try to point out the problems, and we try to point out what's safe. And there is a lot of safe food, and we can do a lot of things to make sure that our diet is just as safe as it can be. It's not a hopeless situation, as you sometimes get the feeling of as you read the newspaper, and every week or two there's a new food scare.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about food and food contaminants, and my guest is Michael Jacobson, the head of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which is based in Washington, D.C. He's the co-author of a new book called Safe Food. We'll talk more about food after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Jacobson is my guest, co-author of the new book, Safe Food. Let's get to meat. The animals that are raised for meat and for milk are often fed drugs to help them grow or to prevent them from catching diseases. Do we ingest these drugs when we drink the milk or eat the meat?
We ingest very low levels of these veterinary drugs, often antibiotics, when we buy dairy products or meat at the grocery store. You can avoid these chemicals entirely if you get organically produced milk or meat. Now, the levels are very low, and only a very small number of extremely sensitive people will be harmed by them if these substances cause allergic reactions, as is sometimes the case with penicillin, say. Some substances increase the risk of cancer, and that's something that could harm any of us, but the risks are quite small. It's not a major worry, but the presence of antibiotics in the food supply indicates tremendous use of these drugs back on farms. And the real risk is that the greater use of antibiotics leads to antibiotic-resistant bacteria. If we get infected by these bacteria, then a doctor can have a very hard time finding a drug that will work and kill the bacteria, because these bacteria may be resistant to a wide range of drugs like penicillin, tetracycline, and so on. So the FDA in the past has tried to ban penicillin and tetracycline, but the livestock industry and the animal drug industry has prevented the FDA from carrying out its proposal. The FDA is looking into a ban once again, 14 years later, and let's see what happens. You know, in safe food, we really urge people to do two things. One is choose the safest food they can, and we give a lot of advice. The second thing is to write letters to Congress, because these Congress people are hearing all the time from drug companies, from hog farmers, and they should be hearing from consumers also.
Michael Jacobson is my guest, the head of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, co-author of the new book, Safe Food. What's your opinion of David Kessler, the new head of the FDA, who's getting a reputation for cracking down on false and misleading claims?
It's amazing and delightful to see somebody heading the Food and Drug Administration who actually wants to solve some of these problems. And he's so far gone after several deceptive labeling claims. He's not breaking any new ground. He's simply enforcing the law. And I'm hoping that he's going to continue to be active on deceptive food labels, on dangerous animal drugs that are used illegally, very widely, on cracking down on pesticides, making sure we have a safer food supply generally. It's going to be very interesting to see. I think Commissioner Kessler is really increasing the Food and Drug Administration's credibility among consumers and perhaps even more importantly in Congress, where he will hopefully try to get greater authority for seafood inspection, to inspect other food manufacturing facilities, to crack down on dangerous chemicals, and also get more resources. FDA needs more money, no doubt about it. But Congress wasn't about to give money to an agency that wasn't doing anything. I think Commissioner Kessler is showing that government can be effective.
Let me ask you a question that I suspect our listeners will really hate me for asking. I'm going to ask you to be a real killjoy here. Tell us all the harm we'll be doing barbecuing meat on July 4th.
Well, I hope not many of your listeners are going to barbecue meat.
No, oh, yeah,
kidding.
I'm sure, yeah.
Well, as far as barbecuing goes, the lower fat food, the better. So if you're going to have red meat, a lean steak or very, very lean ground hamburger meat is better than fatty meat. The fat is the main problem with barbecuing because the fat drips down onto the coals, is burned, cancer-causing chemicals form, and then rise up onto the meat again. So use the leanest foods you can grill. I'd recommend fish instead of meat. And then cook it slowly, but cook it thoroughly to kill all the germs. Use a drip pan so the fat collects in the pan rather than getting onto the coals. Have more fruits and vegetables. Fill up your plate with potato salad made with non-fat mayonnaise, with either raw or lightly cooked broccoli and cauliflower. Throw some green pepper onto the grill. That's terrific. Have orange juice and club soda rather than a wine cooler or soda pop that's nothing but sugar and additives. So I think you can have a real healthy, delicious 4th of July meal and still have a safe, nutritious meal.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody's mouths are watering just thinking about that orange juice on July 4th.
Well, some people may laugh, but orange juice and club soda, I think, is a wonderful, refreshing beverage.
Uh-huh.
Well, shucks, I haven't persuaded you, I can tell. But you don't have to drink beer and soda pop to have a good time.
I should
add also that if you do have soda pop and hot dogs once or twice a year, it's not going to kill you. I think we have to have some sense of proportion about this. You needn't have an absolutely pure food every single meal.
I have a feeling a lot of people listening to you are thinking, okay, well, if everything is poisoned, then it means we can go ahead and eat anything since it's all the same.
Well, that's actually one reason we got involved in this, that we had been preaching a nutritious diet for a long time. And then 5 years or so ago, a lot of people began telling us, hey, why should I eat the broccoli and the cauliflower? It's all contaminated with poisonous pesticides, so I'm just going to eat anything. And I think that's really throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We ought to be eating a nutritious diet, even if the foods are contaminated with low levels of pesticides or animal drugs or dangerous food additives. Those risks are really quite small. The fats and salt and sugar in the foods, the lack of fiber, are contributing to hundreds of thousands of deaths a year. So the first step is to have basically a nutritious diet. And then the second step is to make sure that diet is as safe as it can be with regard to bacteria, food additives, pesticides. And that gives some added safety. For the short term, thinking of substances that cause allergic reactions or bacterial infections. And for the long term, as far as substances that increase the risk of cancer. So it's not time for panic. And we try to separate the dangerous things from the safe things and urge people to enjoy their food, but to try to make it as nutritious and safe as possible.
Well, Michael Jacobson, thank you for all your advice, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Terry, for having me.
Michael Jacobson is the head of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which is located in Washington, D.C., and he's co-author of the new book, Safe Food. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. They say life is the best training for writing. If that's true, then writer Blanche Boyd has certainly had her share of training. Among other things, she's been a Southern beauty queen, a member of radical communes, a suburban housewife, a would-be shaman, and a journalist. A talk with Blanche Boyd coming up on Fresh Air. In the past, rock historian Ed Ward has introduced us to some of the early blues greats who wandered through the South. This time, Ed introduces us to a performer who traveled the South singing gospel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The current unrest in Yugoslavia has now moved closer to civil war after the federal government ordered army and police to secure Slovenia's borders. In Croatia, several people were said to have been killed in ethnic clashes. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli has more.
Only a few hours after the two republics announced their independence, the federal government proclaimed the secessions illegal and ordered the army on combat alert to ensure the functioning of the federation. Convoys of tanks were reported at the Slovenian border with Italy and Austria, and federal troops took control of some border crossings. In ethnic-torn Croatia, a long gun battle broke out in the Serb-dominated town of Glina, in which six people died, and army units moved in after a police station was attacked last night. Slovenian airports were shut down after federal authorities closed the republic's airspace. Slovenian Foreign Minister Dimitri Rupel said it was a war of nerves and not a real war. But observers said that the Belgrade government had no choice but to use force to ensure the survival of the last remaining Yugoslav institution. In Ljubljana, this is Sylvia Pojoli.
In Washington, the Bush administration has stressed that it will not recognize Croatia and Slovenia as separate nations. President Bush has called on Yugoslavia's divided republics not to destroy their country, adding that more violence in the world is not needed. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a funding bill that includes a measure to overturn a ban on abortion counseling at federally funded family planning clinics. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The vote to pass the bill funding the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor and Education was overwhelming, 353-74. But the House was never forced to confront the abortion counseling issue directly. That's because abortion opponents decided not to challenge an amendment by Republican John Porter of Illinois to prevent the federal government from spending any money to enforce a ban on abortion counseling at clinics that receive federal funds. The so-called gag rule was upheld by the Supreme Court last month. Abortion opponents said rather than risk an embarrassing loss fighting Porter's amendment, they would wait until President Bush vetoed the bill. Then they would fight to uphold his veto when it came back to the House for an override. Republican supporters of the measure to lift the so-called gag rule point out that abortion counseling has broad public support. They say they hope the president can be convinced to sign the bill. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The government says that the U.S. economy shrank at an annual rate of 2.8% in the first 3 months of the year. Both a drop in the gross national product and a 6.3% drop in after-tax corporate profits were worse than previously estimated. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 3 points to close at 2,913 in active trading. This is NPR News. The State Department is charged that Iraq has a secret nuclear weapons program that it has tried to hide from UN observers. Officials have warned that they expect Iraq to comply with UN decisions now, just as they were expected to comply from August of last year until January 15th. It was Baghdad's failure to comply with UN resolutions that prompted international backing for Allied military action to liberate Kuwait. According to a State Department spokesman, Iraq has not revealed details on weapons of mass destruction as required by a UN resolution. In Chicago, the American Medical Association has rejected proposals for mandatory testing of healthcare workers and hospital patients for the virus that causes AIDS. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
AMA delegates agreed that doctors should know whether their patients carry the AIDS virus. The convention also maintained that it should be easier for doctors to get their patients' informed consent to the test for the AIDS antibody, and urged AMA members to work to change local laws requiring written consent in every situation. Dr. Nancy Dickey is a member of the AMA Board of Trustees.
If it's a patient I know well, they're in my office, it may be just a verbal exchange. If it's a patient that's in an emergency setting where filling out 20 pages of paperwork is impossible, I can document the consent that we've obtained in a written manner in the chart and get on with treating the patient.
Today's vote does not change the AMA's recommendation of mandatory AIDS testing for prison inmates, military personnel, and organ donors. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Officials say a computer malfunction disrupted telephone service in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and parts of West Virginia. A spokesman says the problem affected most local telephone calls and some outbound long-distance calls. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Blanche McCreary Boyd has been a tomboy, southern beauty queen, hip suburban housewife, and lesbian feminist. Now she's a novelist and journalist and can write about all of it. She left her home in Charleston in the 60s, but returned home from 78 to 82. Her essays from that period were collected in her book, The Redneck Way of Knowledge. Now she teaches writing at Connecticut College. Her new semi-autobiographical novel, The Revolution of Little Girls, is about a girl named Ellen coming of age in the South. In an earlier essay on the subject called Growing Up Racist, Boyd wrote that being a white Southerner is a little like being Eichmann's daughter. People don't assume you're guilty, but they wonder how you've been affected.
Well, I guess what I meant by that was when I moved north, you know, it was very close to the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and a lot of people who I hung around with had been voter registration people in the South or been in real trouble in the South, and they were very suspicious of white Southerners, and so they didn't assume that you were like the people who had been so scary to them when they were down there doing that kind of work, but they did wonder what you were really like in your secret heart.
You've written that you grew up in a very right-wing family.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And a very prosperous family as well. Do they belong to country clubs or golf clubs or whatever that are explicitly or implicitly whites only, and are you willing to meet them there? Is this the kind of, like, decision you sometimes have to make that's a tough one?
Oh, it's the kind of decision I had to make all my life, and you have to make those decisions in the North, too, you know. When I decided to move back to South Carolina, I went into my editor's office at the Village Voice, and I said, you know, I'm going home. And this was in 1978, and he said, I could never live down there. He said, I was down there in voter registration. I said, you know, why don't you get in a car and ride uptown? Why don't you just look where you are? It's not any different from the South, except maybe it's more up front there.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up in Charleston, was there a sense of what Southern womanhood was and a sense of what you would be, what you should be when you grew up?
Well, yeah. I mean, Ellen says that, you know, my mother wanted me to be a professional golfer or a beauty queen.
You became a beauty queen very briefly, didn't you?
I did. I got my little charm bracelet. I still have it.
So tell me the circumstances. What kind of pageant it was or whatever.
It was my high school beauty contest. I was Miss St. Paul's High School. I was also the Rose Queen of Pi Kappa Phi fraternity and some other little things like that.
Did you feel like you fit the role?
Well, no, I don't think I fit the role. It's just about, I mean, that stuff is really about presence and being photogenic and learning to shut up. That's probably the part of it I was worst at.
Now, Ellen, the character in your new novel, says that when she was growing up, she thought there were three categories of people: men, women, and her.
Men, women, and me, right.
Yeah, did you feel that way, too?
I did, and, you know, I still pretty much feel like that. I mean, I'm not Ellen, but I'm more like Ellen than anybody else is like Ellen. And you know, that's what Ellen's whole story's about, and part of, with a lot of humor and good grace and good-heartedness, she sets about trying to figure out who she is in the world and how to be in the world.
Well, your character Ellen, in trying to figure out who she is in the world, tries to pass as many different things, tries on many different identities. Did you go through a long period of that yourself?
Many more. I went through a 6-week phase where I was being a vegetarian. I didn't eat any meat, and then I tripped on acid at somebody's house by accident and crouched over the turkey and ate the whole thing. And, you know, that was my vegetarian phase. Then I became a leather worker. That lasted about 2 months, and I lived in a commune that was dropped out intellectuals, and I lived in a radical feminist commune, and, you know, I have done all kinds of therapy. I've been to Peru and been initiated as a shaman. I've seen two different gurus. I've done a lot of things, you know. Jumped out of airplanes. It's like lots of stuff just to try to see what fits me. And also, I'm a little bit of an adventurer. So some things I just want to do them because this is the only life I've got.
Do you think, looking back, that was healthy to try on so many different personalities, or do you think it was a sign of, a serious problem that you are having?
I think it was both, you know. It's like a person who is always looking to change isn't too happy with how they are, and that would dawn on me periodically. And on the other hand, I think that the part of it was that was healthy has to do with just a very strong desire to, have as much of life as possible. You know, Ellen's very alive. And I think I did things like jump out of airplanes just so I would have done it, not because I was unhappy with myself, but because how would I ever know what that is unless I did it?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Blanche McCreary Boyd, and her new novel is called The Revolution of Little Girls. She's also the author of a book of essays called The Redneck Way of Knowledge. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Blanche McCreary Boyd is my guest, and she's the author of a new novel called The Revolution of Little Girls. Something else that you and the main character in your new novel have in common is a period of problems with alcohol.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Most of my life.
Well, what got you drinking?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what gets anybody drinking? I mean, culture got me to drinking. I don't think any normal teenager doesn't try alcohol.
I think a couple of the earlier books that you wrote were written when you were drinking a lot. When you read them now, can you tell?
All three of them. This is my first sober book, and it came out on the 10th anniversary of my sobriety. And I'm very proud about that. I didn't know whether I would write another novel. You know, it takes a lot of courage to write a novel. And I went through all kinds of funny phases with myself about this sober. But when I go back and look at my early books, the first two books are flawed structurally. I had no what the Germans call Weltanschauung. I had no worldview. In a piece I wrote in 1981, I said that when I was writing those books, it was really like I was more like a practicing schizophrenic than an artist. I mean, there was no core to what I was doing. It made you feel crazy to read these books, you know. And they were talented. And in fact, that was kind of my view of myself, you know, talented but damned. That was, and I wrote to suit that.
When you say that for a while, you functionally gave up writing, what do you mean?
Well, when I first got sober, I had to be very clear that if I never wrote again, that was just what was going to be. And that I wasn't going to drink no matter what. And I wasn't going to do drugs no matter what. And so for a long time, you know, I kept my hand in at journalism. I got some pretty good offers, and I still get amazing offers. But, you know, in terms of writing fiction, I'm just amazed that I did it again, that I did it really for the first time, because this is the first novel I've written that I think is good.
Were you afraid that you wouldn't be able to write without drinking?
I was afraid I wouldn't be able to live without drinking.
Right.
I wouldn't be able to get up in the morning without drinking. I mean, yeah, I was afraid of everything without drinking. I'm still afraid of everything, but I don't worry about it very much anymore.
Now, you're teaching in Connecticut now.
Yeah.
And you teach writing. Is there a certain understanding of writing that you feel that you've gotten over the years and with the problems that you've gone through and overcome and everything that you want to pass on to your students?
I feel like I'm a very good writing teacher, that I know real well what can be taught about writing and what can't.
Uh-huh.
And it's like I think I know pretty well how to get a student writer to see through her or his own eyes and to speak from from her or his true voice, real voice, on what that is, you know. I'll give you a concrete thing. The first thing I assign my students to do is to write something they never want anyone to see under any circumstances and then to go burn it.
Oh, what's the purpose of that? That's interesting.
The purpose of that is to get them to see. There are two poles to communication. One is expression and one is communication. At the pole of expression, you have something like Finnegan's Wake, which is, you know, brilliant, but I don't want to read it. And at the other end is the label on the Campbell's soup can. In between is all the other things we try to do. I think that the way writing is taught in high schools, or at least when I was growing up, is designed to stop you from writing, not to teach you to write. And, I mean, what I want a student to see is that you know, your writing belongs to you. It belongs to you first. You make the decision about what it is you're trying to say. It's between you and the page, and it doesn't belong to anybody else unless you choose to show it. And the sense of power that comes for students from burning their work, this the secret, they burn a secret, you know, is pretty heady stuff.
Now, let me ask you. I understand that there's there was an article recently in a small publication about you or partially about you because, well, I'm not going to get this straight.
Am I gay enough? Is that the
yeah,
one?
Right, right. It was called, it was about whether you were gay enough, right?
Or is my book gay enough? It's not am I gay enough.
Oh, I see. So what's the controversy?
The controversy, I guess, and I was pretty surprised, is that, I have to go back to answer this a little bit, but when Redneck came out, I felt pretty clear that, you know, I don't want to be maneuvered into calling myself gay, heterosexual people don't have to go around saying, hey, I'm a heterosexual. You know, it's like whoever they are sexually is just an expression of who they are. And I didn't want to do that. So in Redneck, I wrote an essay about falling in love with women that's called What Is This Thing Called? And there's never the word lesbian, gay, nothing like that's in the whole book, you know? And I was very proud of myself for being able to write about this whole subject in a real way without ever using somebody else's terms for it. And what I got for that was that Redneck wasn't carried by any gay bookstores. And mostly wasn't carried by women's bookstores either, and that really hurt my feelings.
One last question. I know when you first moved up north, you were really excited by snow.
Yeah.
Well, now that you live in Connecticut, where I'm sure you get plenty of it, do you still enjoy it at all? Does it have any pleasures left for you?
Well, I'm still pretty amazed that, well, we don't get a lot of snow in Connecticut, or we haven't the last few years. I bought myself a kind of badass car this last year that I was really worried about what would happen in snow. I got myself a teenage muscle car, you know, one of those cars that you have to lie down to drive it.
Right.
And the people who pump gas say things like, this is my dream car.
Right. Boy, that's never happened to me.
And I was worried about it in the snow because, you know, the nose of it weighs about 5,000 pounds, and it has a rear-wheel drive. And so, you know, even if it rains, you're sliding. So, but I put 150 pounds of bricks in the trunk, and it would handle fine even in snow. So I guess that's my only snow story. It's a southern car. You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, Blanche Boyd, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was really fun. Thanks a lot.
Blanche McCreary Boyd's new novel is The Revolution of Little Girls. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from Yugoslavia?
Well, today we have a report from Silvia Pajoli on the tensions in Yugoslavia, now that Slovenia and Croatia have declared their independence, and also a talk with a Serbian journalist about reaction in that republic to the Slovenian and Croatian declarations. Also, news about Iraq. The United States has very forcefully charged Iraq with concealing a nuclear weapons program at a site where UN inspectors have been denied access recently. Also, news from Chicago, where the American Medical Association has approved various resolutions, some of which call for not mandatory but recommended testing for AIDS.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the work of the guitar-playing street preachers of the 1920s and 30s would have been just a footnote in American musical history had it not been for two prominent performers. One, the Reverend Gary Davis, was discovered in the 60s when folk fans found him living in Harlem. The other was Blind Willie Johnson. Ed says Johnson's comfortable, successful life is at odds with the haunted, mystical music he left behind.
Well, who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Hey, book of the seven, tell me what's John riding?
The history of gospel music tends to break down into two parts. There's the story of the great soloists like Mahalia Jackson, Shirley Caesar, and the late Reverend James Cleveland. And there's the story of the great groups like the Soul Stirrers, Dixie Hummingbirds, and the Gospel Caravans. But this is the sort of gospel music that could only come up in a big city where churches have big congregations. Right up until the Second World War, though, there was another parallel gospel tradition of guitar evangelists, singers or duos who were often just as itinerant as the country blues singers they so closely resembled.
Lord, religion is something within you. Yes, religion is something within. Yes, religion is something within you. Yes, religion is something within.
That was Blind Joe Taggart. As with blues singers, it was an accepted thing for a blind black man to make his living singing hymns on the street, and even blind blues singers like Blind Lemon Jefferson and Blind Willie McTell made sure they had a good repertoire of religious songs in case that's what the paying audience wanted to hear.
In those days came John the Baptist, preaching in the wilderness of beauty and sin. We thank ye for the kingdom of heaven. It ain't for this is he that was spoken of by the prophet Ezekiel.
There were also singing preachers like Reverend Moses Mason, who would chant a sermon between choruses of an old spiritual like John the Baptist. More frequently, though, guitar evangelists would supply the musical interludes at services.
Kind friends, I want to tell you, because I love your soul, and no doubt you've been converted, but there ain't ever been told. Some people, they'll try to fool you, say there's nothing else to do. But Jesus Christ, my Savior, he got better things for you. He got better things for you, and no one on earth can do. He got the Holy Ghost and the fire, sure can make you true. He got better.
But as we've heard, most of these guitar evangelists were more evangelist than guitar player. Among the handful who recorded, one stands out, a master guitarist and a singer whose religion possessed him in much the same way that the blues possessed Robert Johnson.
God, I don't ever change. He's God, always will be God. God in the middle of the ocean, God in the middle of the sea, by the help of the great creator, truly been a God to me. He's God, God don't never change. God, always will be God.
Blind Willie Johnson was born south of Dallas sometime around the turn of the century and was blinded as a young man either by lie thrown at his father by his stepmother or, as he curiously claimed, by wearing a pair of discarded eyeglasses. He spent the 1920s playing in North Texas in places like Dallas's Deep Ellum neighborhood with a tin cup tied around his neck with twine. He soon became famous there. Word traveled, and in December 1927, Columbia Records set up a makeshift studio and recorded him.
But I just can't keep from crying sometimes. But I just can't keep from crying sometimes. And my heart full of sorrow, and my heart filled with tears. I keep from crying sometimes. My mother often told me,
Angel bomb this love away. To set our wedding compilation, but trust in God and pray. I'm on the king's highway. I'm trusting him every day. Cause I just can't keep from crying sometimes.
Legend has always held that the woman whose singing can be heard on Blind Willie Johnson's records was his wife, Angeline, whom he met and married in 24 hours in 1927. But recent research has brought out that Blind Willie had two wives until 1929, when Angeline succeeded in moving him from Dallas all the way down to Beaumont. Still, he continued to record with his other wife, Willie, right through his last session in Atlanta in 1930.
Well, you're gonna need somebody. You're gonna need somebody on your farm. Thought it's a way, turn to midnight, when death comes slipping in your room.
After that 1930 session, Blind Willie Johnson retired from recording, but not from singing. He was more in demand than ever, his records selling in large quantities, and he made enough money to buy several houses and employ a driver for the car he bought. He continued street singing and playing Baptist conventions right up until 1949, when his house caught fire and he caught pneumonia from the water used to douse the flames. Even then, he might not have died if the Beaumont Hospital had admitted him, but they refused because, they said, he was blind. Blind Willie Johnson's music was rediscovered in the 60s, when songs like The Rain Don't Fall on Me were compared to William Blake, and people marveled at his masterpiece, Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground, When They Laid Jesus to Rest. Anything like it. He said it was about God. Who would argue?
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Burden directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Marvin Miller has been called the most influential man in the history of baseball. On the next Fresh Air, Miller tells us how the players' union he headed changed the game. Also, we listen to some of the worst rock and roll records ever made. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.